today to focus with you on on Krakow, but to use that actually as a stepping stone to talk about a more fundamental issue when we talk about spiritual resistance in the Holocaust, and that is, as some of you may have seen or shared, the topic will be cruelty and kindness. That'll be the focus today. You have the bibliography in front of you, some of the materials that I used in preparing for today. So this is the first volume on the list, Dear God, Have You Ever Gone Hungry? By a man by the name of Joseph Bau. So he, Joseph Bau, who's pictured here, this is a translation of an earlier work that was in Hebrew. This is an English work. He and his wife are pictured here. His wife, Rebecca, saved his life by putting him on the Schindler's List, which we'll talk about in a little bit because he can't talk about Krakow without talking about Schindler. And he became a very prominent artist. So his job, actually, in Plzeżew, which we're going to talk about, was that he was responsible for making placards and signs. And later, he became a cartoonist. So his cartoons, you'll see, if you get a hold of this book, which I was able to get, the Skokie Library owns this book. So you'll see the book is illustrated with his personal cartoons. So he was a cartoonist, and I'm trying to find them. Here's one. Every couple of pages you'll find them, so you can get it. And these are signs that he made for the Germans when he was working in Plzeżew. So here's another one. His name is Joseph Bau. The next one on your list, this is a very powerful book. It's called The Krakow Ghetto and the Plzeżew Camp Remembered by a woman, a survivor by the name of Malvina Graf, who describes her... this is published by Florida State University Press.
Pronounce the name of that second camp.
Plzeżew. Now, remember, my pronunciations are not authoritative. They're probably wrong, but that's how I can read it. So Malvina Graf was from Krakow, then she ran away to Lvov, which I think in English they call Lemberg, and then went back to Krakow, and then she was sent to the Plzeżew camp, which we'll get to. And she has an extremely detailed recollection of exactly what happened in Krakow, exactly what happened in Plzeżew. Names of people who were killed and how they were killed, exactly what happened to them. A very, very careful remembrance. And then, what's that?
Is there an index in
the back? In this one, there is not.
Is that a Skokie Library for Boston?
This is, I got Interlibrary. This belongs to Northwestern. And it's also interesting, after the war, she spent time in Feldafing, which has a whole other story to it, the Feldafing DP camp, which was visited by General Eisenhower on Yom Kippur of 1945, which is for another day, another talk. But so she has a very interesting story, and it's very, very detailed. Remember it? And this work by Eliezer Tzuriel is called Behamir Eretz Uvemot Harim, based on a pasuk in Tehillim, in Psalms, but it's all in Hebrew. I don't think there is an English volume of this. And then the other one, which was extremely helpful, it's called Schindler's Krakow. It's a description of the Krakow story with a lot of photographs and maps. If you want more about this, there is a fascinating collection of maps and pictures, both on the U.S. Holocaust Museum website in Washington and in Yad Vashem. There have actual aerial... I didn't want to do AV, we did last time. You have aerial photographs of the Plzeżew camp where the Germans, in their log, described exactly where Schindler's work camp was and where Amon Goethe, the commandant of the Plzeżew work camp, where he lived. It's really fascinating. You could see it on an aerial map where the Germans were doing some photographs there. So that's in terms of the materials that we have. The Jews arrive in Krakow in the beginning of the 14th century. You remember that we've talked about on several occasions how many Jews migrated from Western Europe over to Eastern Europe. So Jews are settling in Krakow in the beginning of the 14th century. We already have documentation of Jews settling there. There is a shul which is built in 1407 called the Alte Shul, which is Yiddish for the old shul. For those who have been to Krakow, I have not been there, but you can find pictures online. You can see pictures of the Alte Shul, which still exists today in Krakow. So it's built in 1407. And then, we're not going to talk today at length, but there is a very complicated history, of course, between the Jews and the local Polish peasants, whether they're allowed to live there, not allowed to live there. In 1497, actually, all the Jews are expelled from the city of Krakow, and they're moved to a suburb called Kazimierz. I don't know how to pronounce that name, but whatever, if that's the correct pronunciation, that's good. So the Jews are now living in Kazimierz, which is like a suburb, an adjacent suburb of Krakow. So, for example, you know, it's like Skokie to Chicago. So, you know, if you visited, you didn't even know the difference. You could go from one to the other, you wouldn't know the difference. If you look on the map, you see it's essentially adjacent. Until 1868, when the Jews of Krakow are emancipated, and then they are technically allowed to go back and forth unfettered between Kazimierz, which is essentially, I guess you call it, like the Jewish neighborhood of Krakow, the sub neighborhood of Krakow, and the main city, the old city, the primary city of Krakow. In the 16th century, there begins a very significant development of Jewish learning and Jewish scholarship in Krakow with significant rabbinic personalities, including probably the most famous by the name of Rabbi Moshe Isserles. Rabbi Moshe Isserles is known by his acronym, which is, oh, this is great, look who they got for us. Okay. Okay, the way that oftentimes rabbinic acronyms are put together is that you'll take the first letter of a series of words. So this is Rabbi Moshe Isserles in Hebrew. Aleph, Yud, Yud, Samach, Resh, Lamed, Yud, Samach. So it becomes Ramah. So if you go today on TripAdvisor, you want to plan a trip to Krakow, you will find what's called the Ramah Shul. So this was the shul that was associated with Ramah. For some reason, the Germans did not destroy these two shuls, the Alte Shul
and the other
shuls, which is interesting because the Krakow was the capital of the general government, the Nazi puppet government, whatever official government you can call it, whatever that is. It was technically called the general government, whatever that means, the Nazi apparatus. So Krakow was the head, it was the headquarters, and yet they didn't destroy those. I think there were 7 shuls that existed at the time of the war, which still survived after the war. So these are the 2 most famous shuls, the Alte Shul and the Ramah Shul. Now the Ramah was Rav Moshe Isserles, one of the most important rabbinic decisors, and he's very important today because at that time in the 16th century there was a code of Jewish law that was authored by arguably the most important rabbinic figure of the 16th century, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who was a Sephardic rabbi, was born just a few years before the Spanish expulsion. His family went from Spain. They went through Turkey. They settled in Sfat in Israel. So Rabbi Yosef Karo writes the Code of Jewish Law, but it's written from a Sephardic traditional perspective. Rabbi Moshe Isserles from Krakow gets a hold of this volume, and he writes glosses, notes. The Code of Jewish Law is referred to as the Shulchan Aruch, the set table. So the Ramah wrote the tablecloth, the mapa. So for many generations, up until this very day, this writing, this gloss, these emendations of Rav Moshe Isserles frame the life, halachic life, the Jewish life, the practical ritual life of Ashkenazi Jews who are coming from Eastern Europe. So this is coming out of the 16th century in Krakow, among other rabbinic figures. There are changes that come in the 18th century with the advent of Hasidus, who move in the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, and that causes its own set of tensions. But because Krakow is situated in the southern Poland, the Galicia area, there was a significant Hasidic community that develops there. And by the time you make it to the war, so at the outbreak of the war, there are 60,000 Jews living in Krakow, which is about a quarter of the whole population of the city. At the time, 237,000 people are living in Krakow. 60,000 of them are Jews. If you want to see something fascinating, we could have made a very good prezi out of this for today. If you go to the, I can send you this link if you want afterwards. If you go to the Holocaust Museum, the U.S. Holocaust Museum website, there is film. There is a 2-minute video clip of the marketplace in Krakow from 1936. Somebody was there visiting and was film recording in 1936. Obviously, it's a silent film, but you actually see a picture, fascinating movie, this 2-minute clip of what life was like in the marketplace in Krakow before the war.
Is it
that still like the big square that they still have there?
So that I don't know. I don't know. I haven't been to Krakow.
That's what they said. That's what they had.
So you could take a look. I'm not sure if that video is from that square. I don't know. You have to look at it carefully. So
the video is not just of Jews.
I don't remember. You have to take a look if it's just of Jews or not. So Germany, of course, occupies Poland and Krakow in September of 1939. And the general government is set up in Krakow. Hans Frank becomes the governor general, where he's going to stay until 2 days before the Russians arrive in Krakow in the 19th of January, I think it was. I'll tell you exactly. The 19th of January, 1945. On the 17th, he leaves. But until that time, for the duration of that period, so essentially the Germans are governing Poland from Krakow. But they don't actually establish a ghetto in Poland, in Krakow, until March of 1941. So meanwhile, the Jews are kind of, and this is described here in this volume, Jews are living not in a ghetto. They're technically allowed to live, but they have various restrictions that are imposed over time. So first, in January 1940, they have to register all of their property, all of their assets with the government. And then in May, and then in December again of 1940, many Jews are expelled from Krakow because the Germans don't want the Jews there because this is their capital of the general government. And then, very significantly, in June of 1941, the SS established a forced labor camp for Jews. Initially it was for Jews and then it was for others as well in Plezhev. Now if you look, imagine a map of Krakow. So on the southern edge, there is this suburb slash neighborhood, this suburb called Plezhev, which had a very active railway, which is going to be used a lot for Jews who are going to be going from this transit point, whether they're going to Belzec to be murdered or they're going to Auschwitz or other places. So there are other smaller areas, but at the largest, you had over 100,000 people working in this camp. Now, initially, this is something that's important that was, it's pointed out here by Malvina Graf in the chapter that begins about Plezhev. The Plezhev chapter, it changed names three times. It would change names twice. Initially, it was a labor camp for Jews, which is called an Arbeitslager. Then Poles were brought in, and it was changed to called a Zwangsarbeitslager, which means a forced labor camp, meaning not just for Jews. But then, and then this is going to be significant, later on, it was transformed into a formal concentration camp, concentration lager, which became different. The significance of this change, at least the later change, when it moves to a concentration camp, is who's in charge of this camp. So initially, this forced labor camp was run by Germans, but there were a lot of Ukrainian guards. But later, in 1944, when it was taken over and officially turned into a concentration camp, it was actually then fully under German control, and they actually changed some of the rules about how they were killing Jews indiscriminately, and they made people sign documents that they wouldn't just kill Jews on the spot, etc. So, in February of 1943 until September of 1944, Plezhev had a commandant. This commandant became famous thanks to Steven Spielberg and the movie Schindler's List, and the man's name was Amon Leopold Goethe. Spelled G-O-E-T-H-E, I think it has a G-E at the end. So this particular commandant was unusually brutal and cruel. And this is, you only get a tiny speck of the savagery.
So he was the commandant of Krakow?
No, of the Plezhev work camp.
Okay. How far from Krakow?
So it's like, essentially it's like adjacent. It's right just at the southern edge of Krakow.
Okay.
Well, you go over the river.
And that's it. It's right there. I think it's the Vistula that divides the two of them. I'm trying to remember. Yes? I think it is. But essentially, it's adjacent. So in March of 1943, when they liquidated the ghetto, several thousand Jews were killed. Several thousand of them were transported to Auschwitz, and several thousand of them went to Plezhev, to that forced labor camp. And then in January of 1944, it was reassigned as the Krakow-Plezhev concentration camp. And then in January of 1945, the last 636 Jews from Krakow Plzeziw were sent in the direction of Auschwitz. So here, we kind of pause for a moment, and we can think about two frames, which is what I wanted to focus on today. You could think about the frame of cruelty and the frame of kindness. Because you could put these two figures, who we'll talk about for a few moments, side by side and think about cruelty and kindness. So you have two men. The first is Amon Goeth, and by the way, it's very interesting. You can do a lot of research without having to leave your house, which is a nice thing in the wintertime. You can go on YouTube and you can actually see some interviews with the daughter of Amon Goeth. Amon Goeth was hanged by the Polish in 1946. He had a daughter who was born in 1945 who was told that her father died in the war as a soldier defending. And then only many years later, she found out, she describes how her grandmother told her, well, her father had been hanged. And then she goes on to watch Schindler's List and describe what she learned about her father, which is a very interesting episode.
This is on what?
You can find this on YouTube.
On YouTube?
Yeah, the documentary, a little interview with Goeth's daughter. Yes?
Maybe looking at a live program here, and the movie of the documentary that was made about his daughter and her children.
Right.
One of the girls' name was, the biracial daughter was Jennifer.
Yes, so that's also very interesting. A couple of years ago, so this woman...
Yeah, so we saw the movie here where the lady that was the maid in the house, the survivor, the daughter wanted to make arrangements to meet her, and they did meet.
That's interesting.
It was very dramatic.
Right, so there is a granddaughter, that's also very interesting. There's a granddaughter, I think the title of her book is something like My Grandfather Would Have Killed Me, or something like that.
She actually was at the U.S. Holocaust luncheon last year.
Oh, okay, so I forget her name. Oh, so Jennifer something. Just Google it. Yeah. You'll see granddaughter, and so she's an African-American woman, and so she describes what it meant to find out that her grandfather was a mass murderer. Anyway, so you put him side by side with a man by the name of Oskar Schindler, right? You can't talk about Krakow without talking about Schindler. So here I have a picture. This is a picture of Schindler on the right side. And then on the left side, you have a copy of the original Schindler's List. Okay? So Oskar Schindler, he's born in 1908. So he's born in the Sudetenland, in Moravia, to a Catholic family. And he was, I guess you could say, he was a German-speaking kid, and he was very interested in joining the Nazi party. He gets caught up in it, but he wasn't like your very bright academic young man. He's kind of like, he was involved in business, had a driving school. He's like a Stiegelmacher, you would call him in Yiddish. He's a little bit of a Macher. And so he's an opportunist. So when the Germans take over Poland and all these Jewish businesses are being given away, so of course he's going to capitalize on this. So he runs in October of 1939. He shows up in Poland, in Krakow, and he takes over an enamelware factory that had previously belonged to a Jew. So he has a Polish-Jewish accountant who also, of course, appears in the movie, in Schindler's List. And he starts up his business there. And because he's a Nazi party member, he has very good contacts. And then part of his business also is going to eventually include a section that deals with arms manufacturing, which gives him very privileged status among, in terms of the business hierarchy. And then later, at the end of the war, when the Krakow and the camp is being moved and liquidated, so he has just exclusively an armaments factory that's going to be set up in Brunelitz. So Schindler is he's playing his games. He's a big macher. He's making huge parties. He becomes friends with the commandant, and because of this, he gets all kinds of favors. Now, originally, again, he's a party member of the Nazi, group, and he's not particularly sympathetic to Jews, but he's just an opportunist. Until, you have to ask him exactly at what point his conscience finally stirred to move him to start to intervene on behalf of the workers in his factory, most of which were Jews. initially it was about 800 Jews, then ultimately he saves about 1,200 Jews between him and his wife. Their marriage ends, I forget exactly when their marriage ends. There's a lot of other women in his life besides his wife, so I think that was a complicated story. But even though ideologically he never developed an ideology of resistance, but he just became totally disgusted with the horrors that he saw, and he became the protector of these Jews, and that's the kind of the end of the story about how one particular transport of women workers from his group who were sent to Auschwitz were actually released from Auschwitz and sent back because of his personal intervention. And then after his heroic efforts are being recognized, he was recognized by Yad Vashem. He met many trips to Israel. His remains were brought to Israel by the survivors. It's unbelievable. That the story of Schindler is a story in and of itself. But what it got me thinking about was to kind of compare and contrast and think about, you talk about spiritual resistance and you talk about ways of thinking about things. How were Jews treated from the standpoint of cruelty versus kindness? So you have Goethe versus someone like Schindler, and he was not the only one, of course, but he's one of the most famous. And then how were Jews thinking about this during the time? So one of the things that happened in Krakow, as it happened in many places, is documented in this volume called Kiddush Hashem, Jewish Religious and Cultural Life in Poland During the Holocaust, written by Shimon Uberband. So for some who have been here before, we have discussed Uberband at length. He was a member of the Oneg Shabbos Archives in Warsaw before he was killed in 1942. He was not just an archivist, he was also a rabbinic scholar. And he has, if you look on the back of your off-white colored sheets, he has a whole section here in the book, in this volume on Kiddush Hashem, has a section on beards. And how, as soon as, quote-unquote, they entered a city or a town, one of the first things they did was to remove the beards of religious Jews by shaving them off, burning them off, cutting them off, and tearing them off. So is there any purpose for this activity other than intimidation and humiliation?
Well, you're also dehumanizing.
Exactly. So he describes how in whole cities this took place in public places, and in a variety of different ways. And you can go on, if you look on the website, both Yad Vashem and the Holocaust Museum in Washington, they have lots of images of this behavior, and lots of images of many German and other local onlookers who thought this was a hysterical event, who thought this was very entertaining, these public beard cuttings. And if you look on the right side, in 189, on the fourth paragraph, in Krakow, A local rabbi determined that Jews could shear off their beards themselves in order to avoid harassment. And the Krakow Jews sheared off their own beards. And then he describes different towns and how they reacted. So you have not just murder, but you have cruelty on an emotional and a psychological level, because the beards of these religious Jews represented their spiritual identity, of course. Now, you take that to an indescribable level. We go to this book by Joseph Bau on the other side of the off-white page. He goes to describe to you, he walks through the pleasure of camp, and he describes on the top right, and I'm not going to read this inside because I can't read it out. It's absolutely terrifying. So take a moment to read on the right-hand side. This is his recollection. You could just start with the sentence where he starts, using torture, surpassing anything known to the Inquisition with terrifying capriciousness. It's very difficult to read. So this is more of like a poetic description, but if you want a very precise description, in Melvina Graf's book, you have just indescribable accounts of exactly what happened there. You know, the movie, the Schindler's List movie of him shooting Jews from his balcony, that's like a drop in the bucket of a drop in the bucket of the type of cruelty that you're talking about here. It's really, really very, very difficult to read. So you take this and you contrast it with someone like Schindler, who goes to risk his own life in 1943 to Budapest to meet with secret members, to have a secret meeting with the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee to try to describe to them the plight of Polish Jews and what's really happening, what's going on, to try to get the word out, and then to intervene on many occasions. It's really amazing when you think about those two. You know, you put one next to the other. And that's, in a certain sense, that's a choice that people have to make. And that's, I would say, that's probably one of the big things that we're educating about here in the museum. You know, those are the choices. Because, yes. Yeah.
In today's context, how can we justify, when we think about spirituality or religion, that evil prevails so much? How can it's
okay? So this is a,
about it, you know?
Great. So there is a ton. There is a ton that has been written and discussed about the problem of evil, which is an age-old problem, and that became only exacerbated after the Holocaust. I think it's called, colloquially, it's called Shoahology. There is a whole unit, there's a whole discipline of learning which is devoted to religious thought after the Holocaust. So one of the things, recently I was in Israel for a couple of days, I had the chance to be in Yad Vashem, so I had the chance to spend time with a fellow by the name of Professor Dan Michman, Dr. Dan Michman, who's the head of research, of the research arm of Yad Vashem, which was amazing. It's always good to have protexia to get you in to meet the right people. So I spent some time with him, and of course I bought a few books. It was a very worthwhile visit. And that was one of the things that we talked about. He shared with me another volume, which I picked up. There's a lot, I could send you afterwards some, it's much more than we could talk about now. But this is one of the struggles with the problem of evil, which is not new, but this is taking it to perhaps a new level, which is why it engendered so much discussion after the Holocaust. How could it be? How did these things happen? But that's part of the reason why, you know, I'm not sure if this room is being wiretapped by Kelly or Amanda. That's why I don't follow the museum policy of referring to the perpetrators as Nazis, because they were Nazis, but they were also Germans.
But if you have faith, how do you justify any human?
Okay, so let's segue to that for a moment, and that's what I wanted to share, a very fascinating insight with one introduction. If you look on the back of your bibliography, I xeroxed for you a copy of a page of Talmud. It's a whole discussion here about a specific group of people who, in biblical times, were not permitted to convert to Judaism. And the Talmud has a lengthy discussion as why they were not permitted to be involved in the Jewish community, apropos a particular episode which is not germane to us right now. But in the course of that discussion, the Talmud has a remark. This is from an art scroll, the English side of the art scroll Talmud, in Tractate Yevamos in 79a. The Talmud has a comment: there are three identifying marks of this nation. There are three things that Jewish people need to be known for. Rachmanim, harachmanim, vahabayishanim, vigomle chasadim. They are merciful, bashful, and they do acts of kindness. If you want to know what it means to be Jewish, according to rabbinic tradition, these are the markers that you need to look for. These are things that need to be definitional to us as a Jewish community.
How do they define bashful?
So it's a great question. I would say bashful means that it's related to modesty, but it has something to do with sensitivity.
Okay.
You know, a person who is bashful has the trait of what's called busha in Hebrew. Busha means to have a sense of shame.
Okay.
Meaning that there's a sensitive quality to that person.
Almost like a conscience.
Yes, a conscience, as opposed to someone who's callous. Callousness would be, achzarius would be the opposite of busha. So here we are. This is what we're striving to accomplish as Jews and as spiritual resistance, and we know that it's a challenge. There is a section here in Kiddush Hashem that Reb Shimon Uberband relates about Jews who were, you call them in Yiddish, a moser. They handed over other Jews, either their property or themselves. They gave them up from hiding. So that's a treacherous, awful situation. So what you see is that there becomes this struggle. It's not just a struggle for the Germans, you know, because you have people like Goethe and you have people like Schindler, but even some Jews are struggling with this issue of maintaining their fealty to Rachmanim, Baishanim, Golim, Chassanim, to their quality. So here we turn to a very, very fascinating document, which you're holding in your hand in the Toll Sheets. The reason I gave it to you in gigantic print is not just so it's easier to read, but this way you can put little, if you want to translate it as we go along. I have the Hebrew version for you here. And this is a very, very amazing document. This document is authored by Rav Klonimus Kalman Shapira, who was known as the Piasetzno Rebbe. Piasetzno is a small suburb of Warsaw. We're moving away from Krakow to Warsaw, but I'm using this for a specific reason, even though it's not Krakow-based. Rabbi Shapira, some of us have spoken about him before, so I don't want to belabor the point too much. He's found in Warsaw at the beginning of the war, loses essentially his entire family, and now is faced with a choice. He's either going to fold or he's going to continue to lead, which he does. And so he ministers to his pupils, his chassidim, his students, and delivers Sabbath sermons in the Warsaw Ghetto, which is an amazing thing in and of itself. How this survived in a milk can, was found by Polish workers afterwards, sent to his brother in Israel, all unbelievable stories. And Professor Michman told me, when I was in Israel 2 weeks ago, that there is a new edition, a critical edition of the Eish Kodesh, which is coming out in the next couple of weeks. I'm very excited to see that. So I wanted to share with you this particular sermon that he delivered, and this is delivered at Parshas Chukas in July, on the 10th day of Tammuz in July of 1941. So things in the ghetto are very severe, and he has the following problem. This is in the context of something else. He raises this absolutely fascinating issue. So if you look, there are two sides. There's side A and side B, and there are two segments. There's one with the little numbers and then with the letters. So I want to read together with you both segments in the Hebrew, and I'll translate it as we go along. If you don't know Hebrew, it won't be a problem. I'm going to follow every number line right now. He says, you know what's happening? On line number one, Lachain, therefore, Kishe'es Tzara Liyakov, when the Jewish people are suffering, what's the problem? Line number two, Sheha'ish, that a person, Misragel Yoser Lahargish Aleph Ayin is Es Atzmo. When a person suffers, you know what they feel? They think about? They think about themselves. Here I am again on line two, halfway down the line. Ki b'chol hayom, all the day, shakua ba'atzmo. He's sucked in, he's sunk in himself. Line number three, zekoev lo, this hurts him. V'zechaser lo, and this is missing. Ki ha'im efshar shiyaku lo la'ish v'la'ish v'lo yargish ke'ev gufo. Is it possible that somebody will beat you and you won't feel it? So being beaten, what happens there? We end up becoming self-centered. What's another consequence of suffering, he says? Only thinking about ourselves. He says, V'al-yedeisha b'chol hayom, line number four, all day, yesh lo lidog, a person has to worry, al-chayav, on his life, hatuluyim lo mineget, that's literally in front of his eyes. Everybody has to worry about survival. And on line number five, Va'al Kevav, on your suffering, on your pain, V'yisurav Hakashim, and how difficult it is. Nishka Shuv Bahargashas Atzmo. A person becomes sunk in thinking about themselves. It's natural, right? It makes sense. He says it's impossible not to. So he says, well, what's our calling? What is the spiritual charge to which we are called? Go down to letter A. This is the response. He says, Vihine, behold, Kedei le'orer, to generate b'marom rachamim, in God mercy on the Jewish people, al Yisrael lulaham tikas adinim, to sweeten the judgment. Tzrichim, what do we need to do? Line B, le'orer b'kirbenu, to generate within us rachmanus al Yisrael zulaso, compassion on the next person. This is our challenge. This is what spiritual resistance looks like now. It's to overcome the inevitable feeling of focusing on yourself, on the suffering that I have, and thinking about what are the other person's needs. How do we feel a sense of compassion? And therefore he says, what's our challenge? On line D, middle of the line, Srichem Shalom Lehisragel Betzaros Yisrael. He says, what's going to happen? We can't become accustomed to the suffering. Because if we just habituate to suffering, we'll become callous. Right? What happens? I occasionally play guitar, but because I don't play regularly, when I do play, I develop a thickness in the skin on my fingertips, on my right hand, on my left hand. That's a callous that comes from this acculturation, this habituation. He says, what do we have to do? We can't let, on line E, lo yitash tishu bikirbenu, it should not allow them, the suffering should not allow in ourselves, v'lo yichu es harachamanas al Yisrael, it shouldn't dim the compassion that we have on other people. What does Huberman describe in one of the episodes? Very well-dressed women who are going to a candy shop, who are stepping over beggars, children dying in the street. The P.S. Etzer Rebbe says, that's our challenge. It's to fight the unavoidable, the problem of callousness, and to create sensitivity in an impossible situation. Turn to the next side. And now, he uses a Talmudic flourish. And look in the underline section. I'm going to skip down to where it says. He quotes a passage in the Talmud and Maseches Megillah. And you have to remember that what we're doing now, we are learning, we are studying the same passage of Talmud that was studied 1500 years ago. This is the same passage of Talmud that was studied in the Warsaw Ghetto that I am studying now with my 12-year-old son for his bar mitzvah this summer. It's the same Talmud. It's the same tradition. The Talmud records that there was a religious crisis in the days of Yoshiyahu, Josiah, the Jewish king. It was a boy king. It was an unbelievable reformation in his time to come back to Judaism. The people had been so, when he became the king, people were so far, they didn't even know what a Torah scroll looked like. They found a Torah scroll, they didn't know what to do with it. That's how far they were from Judaism. So the Talmud describes that King Yoshiyahu sent a message to a prophetess at that time. Her name was Huldah. And the Talmud wonders, why would King Yoshiyahu send a message to a woman, a prophetess named Huldah, if he could have sent a message to another prophet at that time, who was perhaps one of the greatest prophets of all time? His name was Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu. So why would Yoshiyahu send to Huldah if he could have sent to Yirmiyahu? So the Talmud tells you, I'll tell you why. Why? Look on the third underline. Mipnei, because shehanashim, right? The first line, you see where the underline is. Shelachin be'esha Yoshiyahu hamelech b'tzara shalach l'chulda hanaviyah. He sent to Chulda. Af shegam Yirmiyah hanavi haya b'dor hazeh. Even though Yirmiyah was alive, why? Shehanashim rachmanios hein. That women are compassionate. Hainu b'mnei shegam begufan rachmanios hein. Women are hardwired for compassion more than men. In Hebrew, the word rachamim, which means mercy, has a shorish, resh ches mem, which is the same meaning, which is the same word as womb. Rechem is a womb. It's the same as compassion. Women are hardwired, says the Talmud, to have greater compassion than men. And therefore, lachain, therefore, tamshich yoser mehera es hayeshua gam ololam hazeh. Yoshiyahu, the king, who was at a point of crisis, felt that it was more appropriate to turn to a woman prophetess because she would have a sense of compassion, which is what they needed at that time. So says Rabbi Shapira, we have a tradition that it was in the merit of the righteous women that we were redeemed from Egypt. Good thing before Pesach. And therefore, it's in the merit of the righteous women that we will be redeemed from this crisis. And in what aspect? It's in the aspect of compassion. So this is the message of spiritual resistance that is being conveyed during that time of crisis. Because Jews were confronted, like everybody else, with this dichotomy. I wouldn't use the word cruelty, but certainly callousness is on the opposite side of the spectrum. And what Rabbi Shapira is encouraging the people at that time, this is a contemporaneously written document, this is a drasha that he gave, is for people to seek out ways to create compassion, to cultivate compassion in the face of callousness. And that, I think, is something that is really important that when we give our tours and when we explain the message of what we're seeing throughout the museum, that's the choice that people are going to be faced with all the time. It's, you know, the bystander, the callousness. You don't have to be a cruel, evil, unspeakably horrific beast like Amon Gut to be on the spectrum of callousness. So what we're educating toward, and what's, at least to me, what's so amazing is that you're able to tap into what was happening then and apply it in our own lives. You know, if you think about some of the scenarios that are being described in this Uberband work, when you walk through it, so for example in the section on the ghetto, so that's a place where, you know, Jews were faced with this dilemma of turning in others or creating, if you read Emmanuel Ringelblum's diary, the most unbelievable Gemilas Chassadim societies, right? They give out over, I think they say over 100,000 lunches were being distributed. You know, taking care of the people who were in need, people that volunteered, the unbelievable. And that's perhaps one of the messages, but it's not just a message that we can think about when we study Krakow and we look at Schindler versus we look at Goethe, but we can even look within the Jewish religious tradition and even within the tradition that's happening in the Holocaust at that time, that's what people are being called upon for. That's what the P.S.S. and the Rebbe is telling us, that it's the time for strengthening. Why? Because he knows that it's a time of crisis. Because he knows that that's the opposite of what would be happening. Because when a person suffers, a person only thinks about what's happening to them and the pain that they're feeling. And so the challenge was to somehow, using, I would say, even superhuman strength, spiritual strength, to overcome that focus on self and to create a compassionate environment for other people. And that's the message. That's something that we can think about.